This is tape one, side B now. We were talking about books, how important mm-hmm. they were. You said that you were a curious child. I imagine some of that curiosity obviously led you to books, too. But did mm-hmm. the curiosity, well, what else were you curious about, I guess? Where did curiosity lead you?
I think just like being absorbed in things without necessarily analyzing them, which and the curiosity led me to explore what's around the corner.
Right. This is where the bike was so important too. It was another method.
Mobility and yeah. And I liked the feeling of being in a situation where I was secure enough to go where I wanted and bike where I wanted, and yet, not know what was around the corner, and mm-hmm. even exploring a built-up suburb sounds odd, but actually it really was. I really did get that sense of discovery from
right.
seeing any place or anything that I hadn't seen before, and wondering how it worked, and wondering how it, figuring out even things like, on plane trips, I love to look out the window. Mm-hmm. Just even things like geology, geomorphology, really loved reading John McPhee's books on geology before flying across the U.S. or before driving across it.
Mm-hmm.
And get that sense of figuring out not just what's there, but why is it there. The Bull Island that I spent a lot of time on was actually a recent arrival. The island formed after they built a harbour wall out in Dublin. The wall was surveyed by Captain Bligh, the same guy who was mutinied against the Bounty.
Right.
And that for this long, about 5 mile long sand island formed behind it, and it still kind of was changing. So one of my projects was on how that had happened and how the
mm-hmm.
How much changing was still going on.
And what did you do this project?
It was that would have been a late high school project.
Oh, okay.
Not real research, just more book research, history research.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a point of connection that we have, because I remember quite clearly the day I got my bike, my first bike. And it was the excitement was there precisely mm-hmm. because it did allow me to get away from home, in
right.
a sense, and explore this
yep.
strange new world. And I would do it with my friends as well, and that was also fun. Was there any, great adventure that you would go on with your bike? How far did you leave the homestead and head out?
I think the longest rides I've done were about a 100-mile circuit from...
It's pretty far.
From the house in a day. That would have been up into the Wicklow. That would have been sort of the biggest endurance test, But I for quite often had done 50-60 mile circuits
right.
in a day, and that was later teens when I was able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But that takes you down into the really wild country in Wicklow in south of Dublin. That was the next step in exploration, getting into places that weren't not urbanized at all, that looked
mm-hmm.
as where they really could have looked as if they looked exactly as they would have in Joyce's time and for 1,000 years before then.
Now, were these bike trips that you went on alone, or did you go with others?
Quite often, more often alone than would be usual. But actually, there is a group of people at the school that I went to, which eventually nucleated around. There is in part around a science teacher who also liked biking and kids who tended not to like the team sports, but were still physically active and
mm-hmm.
and biking like that as a group. And group bike rides is a good non-competitive activity.
Right.
I think. And the sense of camaraderie that I never got really from team sports, probably because I was never any good at them, was in part, you could get on group rides like that. And then once we got a couple of friends and I would go, then you can throw all these youth hostels around Ireland, so you can go on several day trips or pretty cheap. So
No, I don't know enough about Irish society and Ireland overall, but I mean, how popular is biking among the populace at large?
Probably less so than it would be, and I'm not sure I would do the same trips because the traffic has got so much heavier.
Yeah.
But it was the standard means of transportation. I mean, it's and very much so. Irish society really, if you go back to the late 19th century, it was really changed by the invention of the bicycle for precisely that reason. You could court the girl in the next. You weren't just limited to this village and the ones around it, but you could range quite a distance. And,
right.
And that, so I think everybody was at that time was dependent on bikes. There was, ever read Flann O'Brien?
Right.
Ever read, there's this whole comic series he has on I don't know if it was a policeman. He did a lot on policemen, but it was somebody who was so wedded to his bike that spent so much time on it, and the roads were so bumpy that eventually he melded with the bike, and part of the bike molecules became part of him. So he took on the personality of a bicycle and would stand on curbs with one leg up like this, slightly leaning over slightly.
Right.
But so there's the bike's a definite motif in.
Right.
In Ireland, it's kind of a pity now that it's probably more dangerous than it used to be.
Yeah, that's happening, unfortunately, in a lot of cities, too. L.A. is becoming very difficult to bike in as well.
Yeah.
I try it, but I fear. You talked about making maps as well. What do you make maps of?
Our surroundings. I think I remember a vacation where he met down in Wexford in the south coast of Ireland, which had this sort of interesting looking beach which had a lot of rock outcrops on it.
Mm-hmm.
Me and my sister and another family who we coincided with vacations for a couple of years running had one of those vacation friendships which were very close, and for that once each summer. And then I remember first making maps of all that beach and naming all the rock outcrops and all the features on it, and that was our,
mm-hmm.
Felt like it was one of those, this is our private land,
mm-hmm.
sorts of things. But I've always liked maps, always like, I've got to just reading them.
Right.
And like them as a way they convey information and look good and going from making the transposition between maps and landforms, and
mm-hmm.
that's always appealed.
And now, I mean, you're a geneticist. You're mapping genes.
Yep, and it's still something I like to do. Probably too much. I like to draw my maps over and over again.
Right.
Rather than make them. Probably spend too much time making them look pretty, and
uh-huh.
That craft aspect of things appeals.
Exactly.
To me.
So there's something aesthetic too about these maps,
absolutely.
Obviously.
Yeah. Very.
They're more than just simply tools,
yes.
to navigate an
yeah.
area. Yeah.
How much of the aesthetics of the natural world you can transform into a map, and how,
mm-hmm.
and how much you can't. That's always been strange to me, both in science and data. That when you transform anything in nature into data, you're throwing away almost everything. And
right.
in some ways, the data becomes the more believable the more you throw away, but actually, especially when you try to quantitate things, you're throwing away so much information in order to make. But the more you throw away, the more believable it comes. But the
exactly.
less you know.
Right. Do you believe that the more you throw away, therefore, the more beautiful is?
No.
No. Okay. Yeah. That was my question. So got to it too quickly there, but.
No. And in some ways, that's sort of something that a problem that's always stuck with me. When I was doing high school science projects down on the Bull Island and salt marshes, and I could just sit and absorb things and not analyze them for way too long, and I wouldn't get anything down,
right.
wouldn't get anything recorded,
huh.
And I can just sit and watch a fly behave and,
mm-hmm.
for way too long. but that said, I do really like elegance and in presentation. And there's two books there by Edward Tufte's books on
mm-hmm.
Visual presentation of data. And those are among the Bibles on the shelf.
It's interesting because I was going through and I was reading some of the letters of recommendation that were sent to the Pew when you were applying for the scholarship, the grant, rather. And I forget now who wrote this, but one of the things that they pointed out was it wasn't simply this article, these experiments that you had done, and the findings. They were remarkable, but it was also the way, the method that I guess you used, how you got to these results as well, and how they were presented. So it's interesting now that you emphasize presentation as well. Yeah. And when you say beautiful, you know, a map is beautiful. You talked about elegance, but what else goes into what makes a map beautiful?
Accuracy.
Accuracy, okay.
The fact that you can trust it. Yeah. Or if you can't, it's not a good map. The fact that you can, or sometimes what's very important, and in some ways what I like about drawing genetics maps is how you can clearly show what you don't know as well as what you do.
Right.
And make the distinction between the two clear. Hmm. And that's very important when you're, say, doing positional cloning, trying to run down the location of a gene. You know, not clearly showing that you don't know the order, you know that we have these genes in an interval, but you don't know what the order is. And you won't know until you do this experiment.
Right.
But almost always, yeah, I have to draw things out or make... let's see. I think there's... Yeah, you could pick up any of the figures. Oh, here is something that I found useful. This is a... So I'm pulling out maps, just the sequence of a protein that we worked on.
You're thumbing through this, but so people listening to this tape know what you're doing. You have a green notebook, and you've opened it up. And these are what sequences?
This is just the four versions of the sequence of the same protein, just as it might be printed out in a paper as a primary sequence, long lists of letters, each one standing for an amino acid. But what I did was sort of... printed out in a light, everything out in a light gray, and then just highlight certain amino acids in colors. Mm-hmm. And just from the patterns of the colors, colored letters made, particularly, say, cysteines in bright pink against everything else in a dark gray, that actually enabled us to identify some motifs that we couldn't have otherwise. And we kind of beat eventually the computers were able to do it all, but we beat the computer to it in that instance.
Right. So you can see at a glance.
So you can see what I was able to pull out. And picking patterns out of text like that is something I like doing.
Mm-hmm.
One of the accomplishments I'm proudest of, again, was something very like that. It was on the protein that I worked on for my thesis work. Initially, it was a long sequence. It didn't look like anything. The computer programs at the time weren't able to pull out small dispersed motifs, but something about one of them struck me, and I was able to identify it as similar to something I'd seen someplace else, and eventually work out on paper by hand the fact that it belonged to this particular family of proteins, helicases. Later we could show the same thing by computer once we knew the answer.
Right. Okay. Hiking. Before we move on, hiking. Mm-hmm. You said this was important. When does hiking become important? Do you sort of combine it with your biking, or?
Yeah, quite often I do combine hike and bike. So the ideal day for me, it's sort of almost an aesthetics thing of... having a circuit that would involve biking out from the city, finding a route to hike along that would involve a ridge with a horseshoe shape so you could leave your stash your bike someplace, hike along a ridge so you get good views all the way along, come back to the bike and bike home by a different route.
Right.
And discovering routes like that to do involve sort of map reading as well as getting out, being sometimes by yourself, sometimes not.
Mm-hmm.
More often by myself.
Right. And how much hiking and bicycling do you do now? Is that still an important part of your life, or have you had to
more much more? I'm afraid in the intention than
execution.
And it's hard. It's the most frustrating. Long Island's a great place to live, except for that fact. Mm-hmm. The highest point in Long Island is, I think, a landfill.
Unfortunate.
even though, I mean. it's even though I you know, I liked getting out into complete wilderness, but semi urbanized or even junked up areas have always appealed to me too. So the salt marsh in Dublin was kind of close into the city and was regarded by some people as almost a dump, but you don't find great wildlife there too. Remember, there's an image that stuck with me of, I think, a sparrowhawk sitting on the top of some garbage that came upon once. It's one of those that,
memorable.
Still is memorable.
Yeah. You've talked a lot about hobbies that you've had, interests that you've had as well. Were there any others, though, that we haven't brought up yet that were important that should be mentioned?
Sailing.
Okay.
Which is not something I ever expected to be able to do, but my parents surprised me with some gift of some sailing lessons. At a place called Malahide, a bit north of Dublin there. Oh, I like that so much.
Mm-hmm.
And then picked it up again when I was in graduate school in Madison, because their campus there is beside a lake and they've got a great sailing club.
How about when you were in San Diego? Did you do any sailing?
No, there? Oddly enough, no. I don't know whether it was just the... Again, the location wasn't very... It was in Madison. You could be in the lab at 4 or 5, decide, I'd really like to get out in the lake and do it within 15 minutes. I never got it together as a postdoc. By then, work was already becoming overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
Though, I regret it now. Or even more sea kayaking, I should have done there.
Mm-hmm.
I may be able... So that's still an ambition for the next year or two, is to get back in the water. It's easier here.
Yeah, I think so.
Good canoeing, good kayaking.
And how about music? Was music important at all?
No.
Okay.
Big gap. Which is odd because I married somebody for whom it is quite very important, and my daughter has now started cello lessons this summer, and it's really great to have music in the house.
Right.
I think we're all exposed to music. I don't know why my parents didn't push me harder at it. Maybe I was very resistant to it, but I like listening to it. But I've made a couple of high school attempts at or grade school attempts at recorder lessons and things like that.
Right.
Nothing really stuck.
Mm-hmm. Now your parents give you these sailing lessons. I mean, how did that work? Did your parents tend to suggest things to you, or did you suggest things to your parents when you were a boy growing up, or both, about, if you wanted to pursue some interest or whatever? What was their role in that?
For the most part, I went my own. I decided what I wanted. It was hard to push.
Right.
And when I wanted something, I went for it. I think sailing, I forget exactly. There was a slight connection there because my dad had worked mostly in marine insurance. And there was always stories about boats and ships, and he had a sort of an interest that for him was kind of left unfulfilled. I remember being taken to boat shows and having him sort of look longingly at boats, which he didn't feel like he could afford then. I think one of his brothers did buy us a little dinghy boat and did some sailing on it then.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about, you talk about natural history and how important that is. I'm going to put this. I guess I'm interested in when your first interest in science arises. How scientific, I guess, was your interest in natural history? That's one way to put it. I don't know.
Well, as I was saying it, in some ways it wasn't scientific. It was as much aesthetic as scientific right from the start, and in some ways it still is. It's last month I was certainly noticed that since to put it kindly, we manage our property for biodiversity rather than taking care of our yard. We got lots of mushrooms.
Right.
So I was sitting out in the back picking all these weird looking mushrooms, and I was saying, "What are you doing?" And I just liked how they looked and wanted to find out what it was that was growing. So it's very much sort of that curiosity was inseparable. I think it's, for me, is inseparable from science.
Right.
It's all part of the same thing.
Yeah.
And I couldn't say I couldn't point to a moment when it said, now I'm a scientist.
Right.
It was always seemed to be part of the same thing and still is.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about school. What are your earliest memories of schooling, of your schooling?
Being scared of Halloween masks.
Right.
That goes way back. Schooling. Starting off being... I can remember, I think about, isolated images probably from when I started school and would have started in age four or five. Vague memories of a kindergarten before then. From four till eight, I was in the local school, and have wanted to isolate memories of that, but more with the perils and pleasures of recess, or having to wear glasses from an early age, being short-sighted from quite early on.
Right.
I think almost the whole time I was in school, from age four or five, probably put in something of a slight crimp. And but wearing glasses early on changes the way other kids interact with you and the image they have of you, as well as your own, which then affects you in turn. So even though I had a natural bent towards being, being bookish, or that was probably reinforced by other people. So he's a four eyes. then going to, so the, a big change in schooling came for me then when I switched to, I think in part, this was from my parents, I think in part because they felt that the standards at the local school weren't high enough, and that even though I had been jumped a grade very early on, so put into a grade with kids older than me, because they thought I was academically able for it, but I think I wasn't up to, that's a huge difference when you're four or five or six. A year is a huge amount.
It is.
So I think they wanted an environment where I could be in a class that was appropriate to both my age and my abilities. So I switched to Belvedere, which is this long-established Jesuit-run school in the city centre, where James Joyce went for a part.
Exactly. When you mention these names like Malahide, they're always popping up in Joyce.
Oh, yeah. Dollyman Strand.
Right.
That's the front side of the Bull Island, the Sand Island that I did all. I hung out in the back side where all the salt marshes and the birds were.
You mentioned Sandymont. Or am I getting that mixed up? Sandymont Strand?
Sandymont Strand, yeah, that was the strand near my grandparents' house. That's where
they
lived.
And there was a tower, the Martello Tower.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
there are several Martello Towers along the coast. We knew all of them.
Yeah.
They're all still there.
Hmm. So I take it then that you appeared at Red Joyce as well.
Oh, yeah.
I mean...
It was required. It wasn't required in school. The Jesuits were... That's when the school... He'd left enough of a reputation behind that it certainly wasn't required that you read Joyce, and he wasn't mentioned much.
Right.
Even though you'd see suspiciously James Joyce was here, carved into the formica on the mirror desks.
That's amazing.
But...
He also mentions...
I think they make more of it now that he's become distant enough to be respectable, even though he was probably visiting the brothels while he was at school.
Exactly, and his book was banned.
The school was quite near. It was in the middle of the city, which was the north side of the city, too. You go to the north-south thing. The north side of Dublin used to be the... way back, early mid-1700s, was the rich part of the city.
Mm-hmm.
Then they built the... I think the lieutenant governor at that time moved south. Everyone followed him. The north side fell into disrepair and became the slum area and the red light district earlier on. But some of the Belvedere was in one of the school. The main building was located in one of the big old houses and got its name from the earl or whoever it was that lived there before.
Right.
So it was a... It was a odd situation. It was a fee-paying school with quite a rich, by Irish standards, student population set down in the middle of what are still pretty deprived areas.
Sounds a little like Columbia then.
Yeah.
Sort of a similar situation. Right. Yeah. I'm a complete Joyce fanatic, so I'm going to throw out one more word and then we'll move on. Right. Clongos.
Clongos Wood College, yeah, it's another Jesuit school. It's further out from the city.
Right.
I've been there a couple of times, I think, when they were playing rugby matches against.
And was Joyce something you had to read and so read, or was Joyce something that you read avidly and you liked it?
I wouldn't say I read Joyce avidly. I never found him all that easy nor natural until I read it, heard it, you know, again, sort of thing. I've probably read much more Joyce since coming to the U.S., like if you listen to it. There are many things that happen to the Irish when they come to the U.S. The main thing is they become more Irish.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, in San Diego, for instance, they had a reading of, I did part of a reading of Ulysses and Bloomsday. And,
that's great.
so I enjoy, you know, and that when you start reading it aloud, then it gets so much better.
That's what I've heard. Yeah. I've heard, too, that people who have trouble with Finnegan's Wake, if they were simply to read it aloud to themselves or have it read to them, it doesn't necessarily become instantly clear, but it does make more sense, and it is more fun. It's more rhythmic and beautiful.
And if you can do the accents right.
Yeah.
If you get that right and hear them right, I'm not sure it makes any more sense, but it's...
Right.
it's
musical. It's more musical. And talk about the transition, then, from the public school to the... Jesuit school. How was that transition?
On the whole, it was great. It was exactly the right move. It was to an environment where the things I was good at were a little more valued.
Mm-hmm.
Though team sports was also valued there even more, and I was never good at that.
Nice.
especially when it was, I think. I could always run fast enough, which was just as well on the rugby field.
It's always a useful skill to have when you're going to school.
But, I think, it was clear when everybody else when we all hit puberty and everybody else got bigger than I did.
Right.
It was time to drop rugby as soon as possible for the sake of survival, and played a bit of squash and. Yeah, played. Never well enough to get good at it.
Mm. How about academically, when you get to Belvedere, what are your interests at this point? And you can take it right through if you like, middle school or high school.
So it's primary school till you're 12, and then secondary school, 6 years, 12 to 18.
Right.
Primary school would have been, books, and more books.
And again, sort of polymathic, moving in all directions.
Yeah, stories about magic, stories about that childhood sense of, which I can see in my daughter, that she's soaking up, and the reason the Harry Potter things are so popular is because you get that sense of imagination and empowerment of... Mm-hmm. Of being able to feel you could do anything or travel anywhere. What else? Some natural history, looking for stone, looking for fossils, looking for...
Mm-hmm. Did you collect insects?
No. Oddly enough, insects were... I know, I think the insects are something that's much more abundant and much more flamboyant here than in Ireland.
But you had collections, though.
Fishing was big.
Okay.
You asked about academic interests. We sort of wandered out of the classroom again.
Well, that's good, too, though.
but...
Were there teachers, for instance, or mentors that you were coming or meeting who were important in shaping you at this point?
Yes, I think, one thing that was always difficult and still is difficult is expressing myself. And I always found writing to be an incredible labor rather than drawing. So I liked art. I liked what the thing is I liked best was, and I felt we never did enough of, because we were tracked into the, oh, you're academically able. Onto a more academic track was metalwork, working in a shop, working to making stuff with my hands. I love that, and still find that some of the most satisfying. Even designing or designing something, making, having something like that made. Even though I didn't make that one. The people in the shop made it.
And what is this again for people who won't be able to see?
That's a it's a couple of. It's machine pieces of Perspex assembled and put together, and what it makes up is a fly motel.
Oh, my.
Mating chambers for fruit flies.
That's great. It's sort of a rectangular block, right, that has these sort of...
With 12 little chambers. The idea is that you can open and put flies into each one individually without disturbing the others.
That's great.
And you can then use it for timed matings of fruit flies.
But you designed this yourself?
Yeah.
Right.
And making in... Just crafting little not very technical bits of nothing involving calculation or but just handwork is something I enjoy a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like I could have done a lot more of that and gotten good at it, but never did.
Mm-hmm.
At school, science. Became emphasized as a subject once we got into secondary school. That's staying within Belvedere, had kind of the last half of primary school, 8 to 12, and then secondary school, 12 to 18.
Mm-hmm.
So you changed buildings but stayed within the same school. I think it's another aspect of stability that seems to be different also between Ireland and the US. You tend to stay in the same class, same school building, all the way from 12, or in my case, 8. Up until you left school.
Hmm. So same cohort.
Same cohort.
You're mixing with the same people.
For better or worse.
Right.
And friendships that may then were, they were stable. Also because other people didn't move around as much. People's fathers or families didn't leave health to go find work elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
They tended to also be stable that way. Let's see. Where are we? Science. Yes, a couple of great science teachers. One, a guy called Michael Gren, who taught us the basic science classes, but also organized those bike rides that we went on a lot. And just not so much, I don't think it conveyed anything particular about any particular science topic, but just the value of it and the worth of doing it. And the feeling that this interest that I had was worth doing. A chemistry teacher, Benji Fenton, who was a real character, had a great sort of gruff way of speaking, but a real sense of style and panache. I remember being hunched over a desk, crouching down, trying to get my eyes level with a graduated cylinder. We told you don't do it like that, you do it like this. And he swept up his arms and poured something into his arms.
Right.
So they sort of got a sense of the importance of elegance in the way you do something, as well as just getting it right.
Right.
I think, though, even through school science, my interest in the projects that I picked up and the entries I did to science fairs were still self-driven, based more on natural history, and which was not something I really got from the science classes in school. And pretty much a lot of the stuff was stuff I would bring into school rather than get from school and bring elsewhere. So a lot of it was self-motivated.
Right. Well, if you would, talk a little bit about those projects. You already mentioned one. You talked about Sand Island.
I think I did two that were... One was on looking at just feeding habits of birds. That Dolly Mantle Island, it's home to a lot of wintering birds, thousands and thousands of wintering waders and ducks, and lots of different species. It's a great place to, and because it's sort of semi-urban, you can bike along on one side and there is this busy, heavily trafficked road, and with your back to the cars, you were out watching this pristine-looking, beautiful to some eyes, salt marsh with all these birds on it. So it was a great way of observing a whole lot of this huge area all at once from a bicycle. So it was ideal. And you could see, because it's open ground, and birds and ducks and waders are pretty easily identifiable. I'm not that great a bird watcher. I can't do the little brown bird in a tree at 100 paces. What it is. I like my birds labeled clearly. But you could observe them all. And what I tried to do was to figure out whether their feet, the way they move from one part of the island to another, and to feed at different times, whether that was tied to the tides or tied to the time of day. And I never really got, it was, the way what a real ornithologist would do by focusing on one species and doing it properly at all times, getting all the data points at all times of the day or night. I was trying to cover everything at once. So it was a very overall description. Spent lots of time spent just looking through binoculars and instead of collecting real data, but it was fun. And then another was same place, same island, just looking at just a transect of the island and trying to go from the parts that had been formed first to the parts that had been grown up more recently, and doing things like soil analysis and species counts.
You've mentioned already John McPhee. This sounds like something an early budding John McPhee would have done.
Maybe. That's interesting. Except he would have written about it much more than I was.
Okay. Any other projects that you want to talk about?
No, I think so. A big shift in scientific viewpoint, I think, come from that, because obviously I was going. That was high school, late high school. There was got some. They had the equivalent, sponsored by the National Airline Young Scientist Competition, and I won a prize in that, I think, for both of those projects. But the equivalent of the Intel Westinghouse Science Competitions here. And that was, that was towards the end of high school, so I'd finished up that with this interest in ecology, natural history, field biology. Went in with that interest to got my enough of the points in the Leaving Cert to get into biology in Trinity College in Dublin. And then, because you specialize early there, before had to decide whether to stick with that interest in ecology, which there was a department there, or then found myself, I don't think this is really works as a science. And then, or at least, I don't know whether it was a sense that the error bars were just too enormous, and I couldn't the sort of precision and accuracy and certainty and knowledge of what you know and don't know that I could get from maps that wasn't to be found there, but was to be found in something like genetics. Making that switch was actually a shift in viewpoint that I remember.
I'm sorry. How soon again did you have to make that shift? Did you have to?
That would have been at the probably midway through the second year of college.
Okay.
Sophomore, right. U.S. terms.
Before we get you to Trinity, though, I wanted to ask a little bit about friendships. You already talked about how you have cohorts. You have a cohort, basically. You're with them for a long period of time. How important did you develop strong friendships?
So the first cohort was the kids who lived right in the neighboring houses, right on the street. This is a street of semi-detached houses, which is your typical Irish suburb, which means that you've got houses that are not row houses but separated, two pairs of houses joined. By a common wall, and then separated from the next house up by a couple of garages with tiny little walled-in yards. Lots of streets of those. So within a 20 yards up and 50 yards down the road, there was a group of three or four of us that we'd been seeing each other every day since the time we were three or four. Of that, so that was the people who you you didn't choose your friends. They were just the people. Of course, they were your friends because they lived beside beside you. That changed. So some of one person from that note. Once I went to Belvedere and went started commuting into the city centre rather than going to school with them, that connection broke somewhat. But the two of them eventually also came later on into the same school.
Mm-hmm. How easy was it to keep up these friendships, sort of the geographical friendships that you're talking about, after sort of the tracking sets in and people are going to the city center or going to Belvedere or whatever? Or is that tracking at all? Am I misusing that term, sort of?
Not so much tracking, but once the circumstances change. I think it was... they're still friends, apart from one guy died early, sort of tragically, around when he was about 30, but the rest of the other couple, one's a salesman, one's a policeman, I'll still make sure to make contact with them, with one of them at least, to whom I was closest every time I go back.
Right.
I wouldn't say, once we've done the couple of hours catching up, there's not all that much more to go on, except apart from talking about kids, which is inexhaustible. I'm conscious of how disorganized a speaker I am when I'm trying to do this in an extended way.
It's hard to pull it together.
You were asking about...
I guess it was interesting.
How the moving to the different school changed the friendships. Yeah, it broke it up quite a bit.
Yeah, okay.
And you made a new circle of friends. But still, weekends, evenings, I'd be back from school at about 3:30 in the afternoon. At least in the summer, days are really long in Dublin, so there's plenty of time left.
Now, are you still in touch with some of this cohort that you're talking about?
Very early cohort from Belvedere, actually. No, not enough. I'm not sure if it's oddly enough. I think. The cohort that I might have kept up with most would have been people in there was a drama club I was in that there are some people in there, but I think no, there's a lot. It would be really interesting to go back to a reunion, and I've missed the last major reunion they had, and find out there. But I remember I think the guy who was the equivalent of the valedictorian made one comment. I think it is one of his. I don't know if it was in the equivalent of the address that he would have given. But I hope that for as many of us as possible, we'll never say that these were the best days of our lives.
Right.
Because, they shouldn't be. It's your life is pretty sorry. High school is the best day of your life.
It's funny, I was talking with a friend about the movie Stand By Me. Have you seen that film? It's about a small group of children who grow up. I guess they're about maybe 8 or between 10 or 11 maybe in the film, 10 or 12. But anyway, at the end of the film, one of the characters says, well, now I know that these were the best days of our lives. And when I hear the end of that film, I feel so sad.
Right.
Don't say that. Let me flip over the tape.
Okay.